نزلت وقلت انا مش راجع وكتبت بدمي في كل شارع. سمعنا اللي ما كانش سامع واتكسرت كل الموانع. سلاحنا كان احلامنا وبكره واضح قدامنا. من زمان بنستنى بندور مش لاقيين مكاننا. في كل شارع في بلادي صوت الحرية بينادي. في كل شارع في بلادي صوت الحرية بينادي. رفعنا راسنا في السماء والجوع ما بقاش بيهمنا. اهم حاجة حقنا ونكتب تاريخنا بدمنا. لو كنت واحد مننا بلاش ترغي وتقول لنا نمشي ونسيب حلمنا. أنا في كل شارع في بلادي صوت الحرية بينادي. في كل شارع في بلادي صوت الحرية بينادي.
أيادي مصرية سمرة ليها في التمييز ممدودة وسط الزئير بتكسر البراويل. طلع الشباب البديع قلبوا خريف ربيع وحققوا المعجزة. صحوا القتيل من القتل اقتلني قتلي ما حيعيد دولتك تاني. بكتب بدمي حياة تانية لأوطاني. دمي دول الربيع الاتنين بلون أخضر وببتسم من تعدي ولا أحسن.
كل شارع في بلادي صوت الحرية بينادي. في كل شارع في بلادي صوت الحرية بينادي. صوت الحرية
afternoon. This is Wilp's Wednesday Afternoon Show. I'm your host, Lori Hoyt. Dick Paddock is out of town, and we're so happy that one of our colleagues here at the station, Sean, is doing the board for us. Sean, thank you.
You're welcome.
And he has played a song for us that's going to lead into our topic and our guest. And the song he's just been playing is Egypt Revolution, Song of Freedom. And that leads into our guest today, who is Samia Sarah-Geldin, an old friend that I met, I don't know how many years ago, at the Chapel Hill Library with talking about her first book, Cairo House. Welcome, Samia.
Well, thank you. It's lovely to be here.
And how many years ago was that? Do you remember?
Yes, Cairo House was published at the end of 2000.
Okay.
And so, yes, over 10 years ago.
And
since then, it's had quite a career. It's been translated into 10 languages. And I've had two other books published since then.
So into 10 languages, wow.
Yes.
Right after I saw you talking about it at the author's tea that the library would have each month, I went out and immediately got the book, and I loved it.
Well,
and
thank
this
you.
Book, as I remember from 11 years ago, was about growing up in Egypt just before the Nasser's regime.
Well, actually,
or do I remember that correctly?
You do. But actually, I was born around the time of Nasser's revolution in 1952. So I grew up under Nasser, under Sadat. I reached my majority, and I left for England because the situation was very difficult in Egypt for my family in particular. My uncle and my family had been a politically involved family before the revolution, with my uncle being a minister and party chairman under the king. And under Nasser, they were considered ancien régime and
they
accused
were considered what?
Ancien régime of the old regime and persecuted, called enemies of the people, and our land was confiscated and everything we owned as well. So it was very difficult growing up under Nasser because there was a certain very much of a police state, a big brother surveillance system. Under Sadat, that loosened up a little bit, but then under Mubarak, after Sadat's assassination, my husband and I immigrated to the U.S. So it's been a long time since I've lived in Egypt full-time, but I go back for holidays all the time, extended vacations, months at a time.
Because you still have family there.
I have family there. I have friends there. Very large circle of extended family and friends. And we've been spending quite a long time there over the past couple of years, especially. And I was there during this latest revolution.
And that's what I've seen you in the intervening years since the Cairo House came out. And I've seen your husband, Mohammed. We had a Bill of Rights Defense Committee after the Patriot Act.
Of course.
And Mohammed was very active in that. But I was so surprised. I was listening to the radio, to the TV during the Arab Spring, during the uprising. And one time I hear Samia Sarah-Geldin on NPR. Mm-hmm. You want to tell us about that?
Well, yes. Actually, Frank Stasio
yes.
contacted me while I was still overseas. And before Frank, D.G. Martin, our own D.G. Martin,
yes.
Had called me, and we did an interview over the telephone while I was in Cairo.
Is this when the revolution, when
this
the uprising
was when
was
it on? Was going on, and
okay.
when we were not even sure of having a telephone, because the internet and cell phones were being cut off in order to prevent people from mobilizing and organizing. So D.G. Martin did get through to me, and he said, Samia, so many of your friends here in Chapel Hill are worried, and I'd love to have you do my show, and you know, you can come home to Chapel Hill virtually over the radio just for half an hour or so. And so I did that interview with D.G. Martin and another couple of interviews for a radio station out on the West Coast. And Frank Stasio also contacted me while I was overseas, but he said, we'll do it your first Monday back in Chapel Hill.
Uh-huh.
So that was the 21st of March, which was my first Monday back in Chapel Hill after being gone for 3 months. So that was a nice homecoming. And now I'm here with you, and we have such a long history as well, what
yeah.
with the raging grannies and the Orange County
civil
rights and
the
Peace Coalition and
the memorial services.
Yes,
that they
absolutely.
Put on at Memorial
absolutely.
Day
yes.
to make it a real Memorial Day
yes.
and not
yes.
just having hot dogs and hamburgers in the backyard. Samia, so you were there for 3 months during one of the most exciting times for a long time. I know there's been, mm-hmm. Egypt has a long, long history, but for a long time, one of the most exciting and hopeful times. I think when I called you about this show, you used the term Arab Spring, and that's such a beautiful term. And so you're there for 3 months, not... Well, I'm sure when you left, you thought you were just going for a regular visit?
Absolutely.
And then tell us about what it was
like. Absolutely. And of course, Arab Spring, I get no credit for originality there, because so many people, almost immediately when they saw a sort of a domino effect of revolutions from the Tunisian onto the Egyptian and so on, it reminded them of the late 80s and early 90s when that happened in Western Europe and in Eastern Europe, excuse me, mm-hmm. and then the fall of the Berlin Wall and Prague and the Prague Spring earlier in 68 and Czechoslovakia and so on. So that was a very exciting time to be there. Now, we just went for our winter vacation, as we often do around that time of year, December, January, February. It's a good time to be in Egypt. It's nice weather. Although, I have to say, there was a little more tension in the air than normal. And I think I probably noticed it more than other people there, because when you've been away even for a few months and you come back, you notice things more than if you're in the country and you're just busy rushing around on your day-to-day schedule.
That's right.
I might have noticed it also a little bit more because we had guests from Chapel Hill staying with us, or I should say from Hillsborough, Lee Smith and Hal Crowther. So when they were with us for 10 days just before the revolution, they left just before, which I'm grateful for. I know it deprived Hal particularly of a good subject for for articles, but on the other hand, I know I wanted them safe and away from any trouble.
Oh, by the way, not to interrupt you, but Hal Crowther did make use of that, and in the last Independent, he's on the a cover, a cartoon of him on the cover.
I've seen that.
And he made a whole story of their desperate getaway.
And absolutely factual. I have to say, it was absolutely factual. It happened exactly as he wrote it.
But back to Egypt.
Having overseas guests, and who are clearly tourists, also meant that I noticed certain things and people's reactions to them in a way I wouldn't if I were in my own context of family and friends.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the revolution in Tunisia, I think I wasn't the only one. We were all sort of waiting for the other shoe to drop. I was in particular, although a lot of people said, no, that will never happen in Egypt. Mm-hmm. Egypt has this millennia-long history of stability. But personally, I thought, you know, it's the other shoe waiting to drop. And it did on January 25th. And I admit that I didn't immediately see if it was just going to be a revolt, an uprising, or a real revolution. And for it to be a real revolution, Mubarak had to go. It was not enough to change the cabinet or to have him hand over power to his son, who was actually even more unpopular than Mubarak, if that is possible. And but in another way, I was very hopeful, but like most people, also apprehensive, because mm-hmm. instability and chaos are always things you fear. I don't think the worst came to pass. On the whole, certainly from on the part of the protesters and demonstrators, there was a very strong will to make it a peaceful revolution. And on their part, it entirely was. Any violence that happened from the Mubarak regime loyalists who tried to break up the demonstrators, or from the police when they first tried to disrupt the demonstrations. But on the whole, when you think this was a real revolution, the total toll, whatever, you hear varying figures, and they're high. I'm not discounting the agony of every single mother who lost one of those 300 to 600, that figures vary, young people. I'm not in any sense discounting that sacrifice, but when you think of it in terms of other revolutions, mm-hmm. it was relatively not as bad as it could have been. I mean, look at Libya, for instance, which is a totally different situation there.
Yes.
Because for Egypt, it never went to civil war. Thank God for that. But also partly because the people or the composition of the Egyptian population is fairly homogenous.
Yes.
So you don't have the tribal system that would lend itself mm-hmm. to a civil war, as you had in Libya.
Mm-hmm.
You also had an army that, although probably the top old guard are still or were still loyal to Mubarak, but I think they did not have the will to fire against their own people,
mm-hmm.
or at the very least, they probably knew that orders to fire would not be obeyed by the junior officers and the rank and file soldiers,
mm-hmm.
and that was a great blessing that the army pretty much stood neutral and later actually protected to some extent the revolutionaries.
That came through here in our media that there was so many conscripts that practically every town and maybe every family had somebody who did their draft time in the military, so that they were part of the people. So they said they were, and that's what I think the protesters were so smart. We and the army are one. Yeah.
And actually, before, and now we know who the administrator was behind that Facebook page that originally mobilized and organized those young people to show up that day. But when it was still an anonymous Facebook page, there were army officers and soldiers who posted anonymously saying the army and the people are one, and the protesters took this as a signal that the army would not shoot, would not open fire. But I very much liked what the young man Wael Ghanem, who was most instrumental through his Facebook page in organizing the original group of young people who launched the January 25th demonstrations. I very much liked what he said when he said there's no one hero to the story.
Mm-hmm.
There were so many, first hundreds, then thousands, then millions of us who just spontaneously got together and did this. And that I noticed in Egypt over the last couple of years. What the Mubarak regime did that did not happen under Sadat or Nasser. Under Nasser, you couldn't even speak the name of Nasser himself. Under Sadat, again, censorship of the media was extremely harsh. Mubarak, over the last few years, allowed the opposition press a great deal of freedom, mm-hmm. partly simply because the fact was that he knew with the internet mm-hmm. and satellite mm-hmm. television and so
it's
on, there
things.
Was no way of controlling mm-hmm. the media message, so might as well allow the appearance of a free mm-hmm. press. But what did happen then is you had so many voices of dissent against the regime,
mm-hmm.
against the idea of hereditary power in a mm-hmm. republic, mm-hmm. what was being called a hereditary republic. And I noticed this just personally myself, because I told you my first book, The Cairo House, was translated into 10 languages. Arabic was not one of them, because I was reluctant. I was very much afraid to have it out in Arabic, because I knew it would be controversial. It very much criticized Nasser's regime, Sadat's regime, but even Mubarak's. And I was afraid of the consequences. But I have family there.
Yeah.
But 2 years ago, one of the top publishers, Shuruq Press, convinced me to have it published in Arabic translation. When it was published, it created a great stir, for which I take no credit. It was the family name and the fact that the papers actually wrote, Sir Aguldeen family puts Nasser era on trial. So it was very much co-opted as part of this national discourse that was re-examining the Nasser, Sadat, and Mubarak eras, and at the same time adding to a trickle to the stream that joined other streams, became a river, and finally a torrent that ended with a revolution. So that was what was going on in Egypt over the past 2 years. It did not come out of the blue.
Well, and out of it, not coming out of the blue, the other big factor that I don't think our media gave enough credence to was the fact that the labor movement and workers have been having increasing strikes and protests about their wages and working conditions. So that was, and they set sort of, I think, a context in the groundwork for when the young people got out there. They had already been setting a climate of protest and a climate of the injustices for workers.
Absolutely, there were labor protests, quite important ones, mm-hmm. especially in the industrial centers like Mahalla. And as often happens with this sort of situation, what you have is an intellectual middle class avant-garde that organizes and launches, but then draws in, has to, if it would have any weight, any chance of success, draws on the disaffection of the masses of the people, and particularly labor, and also to a large extent peasantry, because in Egypt the fact was that over the past 5 years, 10 years even, although Egypt has had what seems like a good rate of growth, like 8%, that did not trickle down. There was a top elite, mostly very closely allied to the president's son, Gamal, the one that he wanted to succeed him, very much allied with Gamal Mubarak. Many of them were business tycoons and ministers at the same time, which created an enormous conflict of interest. And they amassed huge fortunes, enormous fortunes. The people saw that, again, because of the relative freedom of the press. Corruption scandals were constantly being exposed in the press. So the people who were suffering economically, and actually they were perhaps slipping behind, not only was this new wealth and all the new investments coming into Egypt, which are a good thing per se, but not only was all this wealth not trickling down, but the lowest classes were actually slipping behind.
Sounds like our country, but we won't go there tonight.
Okay, and the disparity became quite shocking, especially since these new billionaires had no compunction about conspicuous consumption, mm-hmm. To the extent that to someone coming even from the States and coming to Egypt and seeing this, I used to feel uncomfortable with the display that some people put out when other people were so clearly suffering. And this was being talked about. Now, post-revolution, and this is a revolution that is very much played out on the social media, like YouTube and Facebook and so on. If you see some of the YouTube videos that have been posted during the revolution, because these young people work very quickly. So some of them, like the song that you heard at the very, this little clip of the song that you heard at the very beginning, represent very much the aspirations of the young intellectual internet media hip people. But there are lines about I want my dignity, and hunger is no longer the first thing on my mind. But in effect, there are other YouTube clips and other songs that very much express the frustration of people who feel they are hungry, they can't get ahead. They may be university graduates with no hope of a job. They may be workers who work very hard but cannot make ends meet. And they are expressing their frustration with what they perceive, very often legitimately and sometimes perhaps not, but that's the problem. When there is corruption in a country, it is perceived as being completely across the board and widespread. So there's this perceived corruption on the part of the top elite, not all of whom may be corrupt, certainly. I'm not suggesting they are. But the fact is, that was the perception. And today, many of these business tycoons, many of these ministers are under investigation for corruption, and those who presumably are innocent will easily prove that, and those who are implicated in gross misuse, mismanagement of power and of state funds will hopefully pay a price for that. So
in a revolution so far, this one it doesn't sound like has made major missteps, but certainly there's some reports coming out that the army, while it stood by the people in the revolution, they're not probably good at ruling, and it sounds like they have been doing some crackdowns that have been of concern. And the most recent thing I heard about was a blogger just in the last few days who was making some complaints about what's going on. I'm not sure what they were, but the army has sentenced him in a military tribunal to 3 years in prison. And you probably know a lot more about this than I do.
Yes,
if you want to talk about what's happening right now.
A young man called Mikhail. And it's extremely disturbing because originally it was the arrest and interrogation, but in that case, it was by the police. The arrest and interrogation of a young man called Khaled Said and his death under interrogation, under torture, that launched the Facebook page, We Are All Khaled Said. That was the page on which the January 25th demonstrations and eventually the revolution was organized. So it's very disturbing and troubling that another blogger today should be arrested and sentenced, and so rapidly.
Yes.
That is also the problem with of course, having the military in power, because then you have martial law.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened is because of the fact that once the Mubarak regime was toppled and the people no longer wanted the NDP party, which is Mubarak's party, and which in effect was for all intents and purposes the ruling party, almost a single party system. There were other parties, but they were so emasculated that they were reduced to party, opposition party newspapers, very effective as newspapers, but not effective in contesting seats in parliament for many reasons I won't go into, but because it was rigged that way as well. So as a result, the NDP, no one wanted the NDP back in power. The cabinet was dismissed and so on. So the army was needed to restore order and to hold the balance. Everyone was agreed on that, but everyone, including the army, at least publicly, the agreement is that that is a temporary situation until the elections in September that will bring parliamentary elections and then in December presidential elections. And then there will be a body of civilians to rule the country. The army in Egypt, for the past 60-some years, since 1952, it's good to remember that, although it may have been behind the scenes, but it was, in fact, the kingmaker and also held the balance of power. Nasser, of course, was a military man and came to power by military coup. Sadat was a military man, and so was Mubarak. He was the head of the Air Force. And the army itself is not monolithic. So the old guard, the top brass, are Mubarak loyalists, like Tantawi, who is the defense minister, were. But the junior ranks and so on are much more sympathetic to their generation, the younger generation, and see the role very differently.
Samia, I'm going to interrupt us for just a minute and catch your breath and just say this is a station break right now. And I want to tell about our underwriter, which is Internationalist Books on 405 West Franklin Street. And this is one of the few independent bookstores left. There's a couple of other good ones, but it's not a big box store, and you can find books there, particularly on politics and culture, that are hard to find elsewhere. Plus, it is not just a bookstore, it is a community resource center. So we encourage you to go down or go on the internet to internationalistbooks.org. And Sean, you want to give our station
I do.
Yeah.
I also want to say I like that bookstore as well. Really nice people there.
Yeah, they are. Very, very dedicated. A lot of young people. Really,
good people.
Yeah.
You've been listening to WCOMLP Chapel Hill and Carrboro, 103.5 FM, WCOMFM.org, your community voice.
And this is WILP, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. It's our Wednesday afternoon show. We're on every Wednesday afternoon from 5 to 6 o'clock. And we bring you a lot of the news that you're not going to get in big box stores and not going to get on the regular commercial media. So we're very happy to have you listen. And if you're having some problems with static, because we are a low power station, you can stream us live on WCOMFM.org. Yes. And our guest today is Samia Sarah-Geldin, who is Egyptian. And has lived in this country for many years.
30 years.
30 years. Has written 3 books. If we have time, we'll try to get to the other two. We've been talking about her first book, and that's when I first met Samia, Cairo House, which was about, growing up during the Nasser regime and the impact that it had on your family, which was an old, respected family in Egypt. And we've mostly been talking about the current wonderful, exciting Arab Spring in Egypt. And Samia was there visiting her family. And we're talking right now about some of the fears and concerns as with all revolutions, you have the revolution, and then it's getting things sorted out and getting a democratic government in place, and that's in process right now. And right now the army is hopefully holding things together until there's elections and there can be a civilian government, but it's a kind of a fraught with danger time.
Absolutely, Lori. And just to come back to something you said, I'm a hyphenated Egyptian in the sense that I'm Egyptian-American.
Ah.
So
I wasn't sure about that.
No, absolutely. I've been a proud American for 25 years now.
Okay.
And I think I was just telling someone yesterday that what sums me up, I'm being, tongue-in-cheek here, but it's true. What sums me up is that this year I have 2 pieces in an anthology called A Literary Map of Cairo, which includes 60 writers, including Naguib Mahfouz and other Egyptian writers living and dead. But also this year, I will be, I think very soon, out in a publication called 27 Views of Chapel Hill. I will have a short story in that called Muslims in the Cul-de-Sac, which is a little bit about the experience of being Arab American post 9/11 in Chapel Hill. And that is part of my latest book, a short story collection called Love Is Like Water. I read from that on the radio on NPR, yes.
Yes. And so, what's the name of it again?
Well, the book is called Love Is Like Water and Other Stories. And one of the other stories is Muslims in the Cul-de-Sac. So that will also be in an anthology of 27 views of Chapel Hill. And I'm also in the literary map of Cairo. So that sums me up. A foot there and a foot here.
What a wonderful place to feed in.
I'm privileged and maybe cursed as well with having double vision. But that's very useful when you're in the middle of a revolution in Cairo, because you see things both from the inside and from the outside. And for a while, watching what was happening with in the early days of the revolution, I was, as I think I mentioned a while ago, I was a little bit torn. I very much believed, along with everyone else, that the Mubarak regime really had mismanaged the past few years terribly. I'd already criticized it in the Cairo House all these years ago, but even more so since then. And that there was a level of a police state presence that was extremely, there was no accountability on the part of the security, the police security services in particular, mm-hmm. which is why the army was such a welcome presence, because mm-hmm. it counterbalanced the very much feared police services. And at the same time, there was, as we mentioned, corruption. There was a great deal of mismanagement. But on the other hand, I was also concerned about what happens if the regime topples. Because Mubarak, for all of his 30-year reign, I think, because Sadat was assassinated 30 years ago and Mubarak replaced him instantly since he was vice president. Mubarak since then had been ruling under emergency law. Think about it, 30 years of emergency law, which means that the police services had the power to arrest, detain, and torture with complete unaccountability. Emergency laws are usually seen as being temporary.
Emergencies.
Yes, this lasted for 30 years, which is why, Laurie, you and I, when the Patriot Act was being discussed, from my perspective, although I could see the emergency presented, but at the same time, I know that once emergency laws are on the books,
that's right,
they can last a long time. And originally, Mubarak's justification was, I need these emergency laws to hold the Islamists in check. But of course, once the laws are there, once the unaccountability is there, these powers to arrest, detain, and torture without accountability were applied to any dissent, including simply a young man who's a blogger, who's never been an Islamist in his life. But that was more or less Mubarak's choice that, or no choice that he gave, not just the people, but world opinion, mm-hmm. particularly U.S. opinion or public mm-hmm. opinion. He would say, it's me or the Islamists.
Yes.
And to some extent, even I had my apprehensions. Well, if Mubarak topples, who will take over? Well, what happened, in effect, was better than anything any of us could have expected. In that it was a secular revolution, it was an enlightened one, it was one that was self-consciously and explicitly secular, peaceful, democratic, concerned with social justice for the disenfranchised in society. So it was increasingly hopeful. Still, I only went down to Tahrir myself. I went down twice, but the first time I went down, there was a catalyst for that, because I watched these millions of young people gathering, and I thought, they don't need another warm body, and certainly not the warm body of a woman old enough to be their mother. But
I don't believe that, but go ahead.
But what moved me was when I saw the thugs, and one has to call them that, really, because of their behavior, of the so-called Mubarak loyalists, some of whom were probably, according to the best sources, police services in disguise. Others were party henchmen who came in on the night of February 2nd and with horses and camels. You might have seen that. It was a medieval scene with swords and horses and camels and Molotov cocktails. The whole scene was surreal.
Yeah, it was.
We actually saw the cavalcade going across the riverbank, and a friend there said that it looked something like Braveheart. It was just very, very shocking and unusual. After I saw that, I thought, none of us can afford to sit on the sidelines. And all of the people of my generation who had been sitting on the sidelines suddenly went down, because they all felt they had to protect their kids. Now, I had no kids there. Mine are American, and you know, they live either in the States or in London. But I felt the same thing, that we all had to go and be a protective presence for these young people, so that they, at the very least, they wouldn't be rounded up and arrested and disappeared.
Yes.
So that was the first time I went down to Tahrir. with a friend, and she was carrying juice, little cartons of juice, and I was carrying cookies that she had had the foresight to bring. I forgot to bring anything because these young people there didn't have supplies, and it was...
I love that. The revolution, mama's going down with juice and
cookies. Exactly. And those little sippy juices that children take to kindergarten, that's what we were carrying. But they were very, very much welcome. These supplies were so welcome. And all these young people had manned their own security entrances to Tahrir to make sure that no infiltrators came in and caused havoc. And inside, though, it was very peaceful. People were spontaneously chanting, singing, sometimes playing music. People had brought families. They'd brought their children. As one man said when I asked him why he brought his little girl with him, I said, shouldn't you have left her at home? It would be safer. He said, but I'm here because of her, her future. And, he said, she may never see this again. I don't know how long this will last. This may be her one chance to see this. And that's why I'm bringing her. And fathers told me that about their sons and mothers about their daughters. And the other thing as well was that you have to remember that part of the emergency laws meant that any assembly of more than five people was considered an illegal assembly unless you had asked for a permit ahead of time. Obviously, it wasn't enforced all the time, but the law was on the books and could be enforced selectively, and people knew that. And that the idea of assembling in the millions felt to Egyptians like reclaiming their street, reclaiming their country. That's why it was so important to them. Perhaps you're watching here just saw the sheer numbers, but you may not have understood the point that for them, just being able to say, no, this is my street, this is my city, this is my country, I will walk down my city street if I want to. Mm-hmm. You can't stop me. If we do it in sufficient numbers, the law of assembly cannot be used to prevent us. Mm-hmm. And that was the great beauty of it, and the reason why you saw people just elated.
Yeah.
And it somehow seemed to bring out the best of them. I won't say that this has lasted or will last, but I will say that there is something about a revolution, a genuine one, that seems to inspire people to their very best. Mm-hmm. So in general, the people there behaved so well. When I was there, and I went there twice, I was constantly surprised by the courtesy. There was no pushing, there was no shoving. Although
and they would clean up each
other. And they were cleaning up. They were looking out for each other.
Yes.
They were protecting the women. The women were not harassed. The challenge now, I think, will be to hold on to that spirit.
Yes.
Will be to hold on to the sense of elation and euphoria and being called to be better than your normal self. That will be the challenge, to hold on to that. And to hold the army accountable and to hold the army responsible, but also to move the transition to a civilian system as quickly as possible. Without, however, falling into the trap of the fact that the only organized parties at the moment are either Mubarak's discredited NDP or the Muslim Brotherhood, because those are the only organized parties by design. That was what Mubarak brought about over 30 years. However, a coalition of all the new democratic revolutionary movements could counterbalance that. And as we speak, Mubarak and his sons are being tried. And my great hope is that although I do believe that the principle of accountability is supremely important to affirm in the face of other would-be dictators or current dictators, it is important to affirm accountability will apply. There will be a day of reckoning. But at the same time, I have every hope that the trials will be fair, transparent, open, orderly and in the best spirit of the revolution.
So that other dictators might say, maybe I better step down rather than, because if it's just going to mean a bloody fate, I'll hang on to the bitter end. So you're absolutely
exactly.
right. This is really, really critical.
Exactly. If they realize that there is a graceful way out.
Yes.
Or at least a fair trial. That will be a very good outcome. Yes, Laurie, thank you for that. Yeah.
Samia, I'm so glad you came, and I feel we could talk a lot more, and I'd love to have you back to talk some more about your books. This has been so wonderful to talk. You know, I've watched Amy Goodman, and she had one of her young guys, Sharif, I can't say his name right now, but he's Egyptian, and maybe Egyptian-American too, but he's on Amy Goodman's. He's one of her producers, and he was there also. Mm-hmm. And so he went and did a lot of interviews with the people. So it was not just crowd scenes, and it was just so moving and so wonderful. So I hope that, and Mohammed, I'd love to have you on too. We can talk about the Bill of Rights Defense Committee sometime. I just have to make a quick announcement. That tonight, BAJ, Balance and Accuracy in Journalism, Jerry Markitis's group, is going to be tonight at the Community Church at 7:30. They are going to have two Palestinian women on, and the topic is going to be, what rights do Palestinians have? And the women are Salma Duaitis and Natalie Tabar. They're both with Legal Aid in Jerusalem and the West Bank. So any of you who don't have plans for tonight and have a little energy, please get over to the Community Church on Purefoy Road at 7:30. And this will be, again, another really, really good program. So, Samia, thank you again. It's been delightful. And wonderful to see you
My pleasure.
Being right there.
My pleasure. Thank you, Laurie. Thank you very much.
And Mohammed, good to see you. And so I hope I'll see you both and coming back to this station. And Sean, thank you for playing Egypt Revolution, Song of Freedom.
You're so welcome. That I'm going to close us out
thank on
you,
that.
Sean.
You're very welcome.
And by the way, this is WILPS, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. This is our Wednesday afternoon show. Come on, listen to us next Wednesday. And I'm Laurie Hoyt, your co-host. And Dick Paddock will be back next week, I hope. Take care, everybody. Thanks for listening.
نزلت وقلت أنا مش راجع وكتبت الدم في كل شارع سمعنا اللي ما كانش سامع واتكسرت كل الموانع سلاحنا كان أحلامنا وبكرة واضح قدامنا من زمان بنستنى بندور مش لاقي مكاننا في كل شارع في بلادي صوت الحرية بينادي في كل شارع في بلادي صوت الحرية بينادي رفعنا راسنا في السماء والجوع ما بقاش